Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This
is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least three times a month, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreather. Today on episode 468, we have the preview of the June 2025 edition of Retinal Physician. Retinal Physician can be found online and is also available in print. It's free online at retinalphysician.com. I'm joined by three of my colleagues today. Talk about the articles there. We spent some time talking about diabetic retinopathy. We also spend a little bit talking about a cool protocol for CREO and with discussion of early career advice for early attendings. As always, you can find disclosures in the episode description, and I hope you enjoy this episode. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is back with a preview of the June 2025 edition of Retinal Physician. As a reminder, Retinal Physician is found in print and online for free at retinalphysician.com. This edition focuses a little bit on diabetic retinopathy, but we kind of take a walk around many retina topics for this one. I'm happy to be joined by three colleagues from around the country. First, in alphabetical order, from the Bay Area, Dr. Ramsuda Narala. She is joining us for the first time. Welcome.
Thank you for having me, Jay. Appreciate it.
And then I have Dr. Kat Talcott. She's in Cleveland.
Thanks for having me again, Jay.
And Dr. Sarwar Zahid, sleep deprived from watching Knicks games too late on the East Coast, joining us from New York. Sarwar, welcome.
Thanks for having me back, Jay. Let's go, Knicks.
I hear the scratchiness in your voice. I know what you've been doing every other night for the last week. Yep. So let's jump right in. So again, these are not designed to be journal club articles. These are sort of overview articles. And what I'll do is kind of give a quick summary of the article and use them to discuss. So this first article is about GLP-1 RAs and diabetic retinopathy with the subtitle Real World Studies Present Mixed Evidence on the Link Between GLP-1 RA Use and DR Progression by Julia Ju and friend of the program, Alexander Retina Sky from Cleveland Clinic. And so this is a topic we actually done a few journal club articles about this. This is kind of a interesting concept, right? Because in the they reference how there were a couple of studies, the CVOT from Sustain 6 showed a greater risk of DR-related complications, which was the need for a laser, intravitreal injection, or blindness or development of vitreous hemorrhage. It wasn't a huge difference. So semaglutide users was 3% versus 1.8% placebo, but it was significant with hazard ratio of 1.76. And that's why there was an FDA label for increased risk of DR progression. And so we've all gotten a lot of these questions, right, from PCPs and endocrinologists often were referring us questions. And interesting, we'll get into this a little bit. It's interesting because within our community, I feel like we don't discuss this as much. We can talk about why maybe we're not cavalier, but maybe a little more tolerant of the effects of GLP-1 RAs. So they talk a little bit about why this may be, right? So one idea could be it'd be too rapid or dramatic glycemic control, which is a early worsening of diabetic retinopathy. This is something that has been known since insulin in the 1980s. But the question is, could it be something class specific? And remember, we did review a paper by a group from Stanford a couple months back where they looked at GLP-1s versus SGLT2 inhibitors. And there was a difference in sort of a retrospective analysis. So maybe something specific to GLP-1 RAs. And again, they talk about one of the big issues in the second section is there's sort of this mixed, there's a mixed sort of evidence, right? So there's some evidence, they talk about studies showing that difference. Karen Y from Stanford, also Lynn from Taiwan, showing the difference between GLP-1 RAs and SGLT2. However, there are a lot of other big database studies, including from Mayo, from Barkmeyer, that showed really no difference. And again, big data studies are often limited. They talk about limitations we've talked about before in terms of coding and how do you code for diagnostic change? How do you code for severity change? Obviously, that's going to be, depending on where you're pulling that data from, all over the place, and you become a messy picture. So they kind of talk about the last thing, I think, is they talk about neuroprotection, right? There may be independent neuroprotection because they may be anti-inflammatory. They may actually help for DR if you look at animal models and some of the preclinical data. So on the other hand, there may be neuroprotection for Alzheimer's and Parkinson's, glaucoma, AMD. Again, some of that data is a little bit messy. And they end with just sort of, how do you assess that? And there is the FOCUS trial. They talked about this. We'll assess long-term effects of DR in 1,500 patients randomized to semaglutide or placebo, which is, we can talk a little bit about that design. That's a very interesting sort of way to look at it. And there are no recommendations. They, you know, maybe not calling out the AO, but suggesting there should be some recommendations given all the questions. The AO does not have any sort of guideline. And most retinal experts, they say, do say get a baseline eye exam, follow them within the first 12 to 18 months, especially if they have more severe DR, higher A1C, and a drop in glycemic control, improvement in glycemic control over the first few months. So let's jump right in. A lot to digest there, Rem. So I think one of the interesting concepts, right, is PCPs, endocrinologists talk about this a lot. I don't know how it is in your system, but I'll get messages from PCPs saying, oh, is it okay? I've got one actually just before the long weekend. We're recording this after Memorial Day weekend. PCPs are like, hey, I've got this patient, they're getting injections with you, I'm worried about starting them on Ozempic. And again, from our standpoint, we're like, do, that's fine, move on. Like, I'm seeing them anyway. I'm curious how often you get these questions. And it, my thought would be the reason our community doesn't talk much about it is because we're like, well, if you're between improving their sugar control and maybe having a problem and not improving their sugar control and almost certainly getting a problem, it's better to go that way. And we just make sure they're plugged into us. But I guess part of the issue is we're only seeing the patients who are plugged into us, the patients we get messages on. We're not seeing the other patients. So just curious about your experience out on the Bay Area and at Stanford.
Yeah, no, I actually get this question pretty often, a message from a PCP saying, oh, I see this patient has diabetic retinopathy. Should I start them on Ozempic? So for me, at least, I have been saying, yes, we're not, it's quite controversial at this point whether they actually truly cause diabetic retinopathy progression. And I actually work in the county system. So a lot of my patients' A1Cs are extremely high, and they may not regularly follow up, and they have severe disease overall. But I think overall, at least from my perspective, the starting them on these medications that have cardiovascular benefits, as well as all these other benefits that have been very well established in the trials, outweighs like maybe the mild retinopathy progression they may have. If it's a patient with like severe non-proliferative diabetic retinopathy or PDR, I would probably follow those patients closer, but often I'm already following them on a monthly basis, so I'm not necessarily as concerned.
Yeah, and Kat, I think those are all fantastic points. And part of it probably, like Ron's referencing, it depends on the patient population you deal with, right? My county, I mean, our A1Cs, you're talking about baseline before you put them on therapy, they're double digits usually. And so those are going to be patients who have more pronounced drops. I'm just surprised every time I see like, oh yeah, it was a definite difference, 3% versus 1.8, right? So certainly for that individual patient, it may matter. We don't fully understand which patients are at risk. That'd be the most helpful, would be like, oh, is there something phenotypically or genetically different about those patients where they have more response? But that's probably why the data is mixed, is it's anytime you have like a small subpopulation that probably has an idiosyncratic or some sort of reaction to the medication, or they're more prone to EWDR, you're going to capture that in some studies, you're going to capture in others, just depending on where your p-value falls, because it's always going to be close. Versus if you could really narrow down in that population, you probably could capture the significant differences, risk stratify, and give better advice. I just think it's going to be really hard. It's good that they're doing this study. We can talk a little bit about study design too, while I get your comments. Like, I think it's a reasonable study. It's just maybe I have to look more at it. It just seems like randomizing versus placebo is an interesting way to do it. I feel like you're going to get the same problem. You're going to get some patients who get better because they have better sugar control. You're going to get some patients who get worse. And then it's going to average out probably to something in between that'll be unsatisfying. Versus it would have been more interesting to do a head-to-head comparison of like Ozempic, semaglutide, something versus a different class where you could get a similar A1C reduction and then compare the two and say, okay, we got the same A1C reduction, but is the retinopathy severity different between these two groups?
I think that's a really good point there. I mean, I think it's always going to be hard to find two similar populations with similar risk factors and to be able to control for that and just be able to sort of change the medication between the two to make a difference. I totally agree with Rams on this. I almost like stopped thinking about this as being an issue in my sort of day-to-day practice of patients, because I feel like all of these medications do such a great job, you know, and I'm thinking about individual patients, but really controlling their diabetes more, that, you know, we're already seeing these patients. And when I think about these large database studies, I just think about how inaccurate, to be honest, even myself, coding is for some of my diabetic patients. Mm-hmm. Like, how many patients do we take care of who we've seen for years and call moderate, and then suddenly they get sent back to us because they have a hemorrhage or something?
Yeah.
So we somehow skipped severe, like early PDR, probably just missed along that way. It's funny because for me, the more the issue that the GLP-1s now brings up more in my practice rather than this risk of progression is actually the anesthesia risk that patients, at least in our institution, need to be off these medicines for a full week before anesthesia will take them for, allow them to have surgery. And that, to be honest, feels like the much bigger deal in my clinic.
Yeah.
Is that, you know, I'll see someone and I'll want to do surgery on them that week. And then I have to think about when they got their injection because it's once, these are like once a week drugs. And so.
Right.
I almost feel like that what is takes up more space in my sort of epic
mind space. Yeah.
message mind space.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I think it's interesting what you said about severity, and Sarwar, you can comment on this. Like, we also don't really code down severity, right? So like most of us, and I'm curious what you think, most of us, we say, okay, once you're PDR, it doesn't matter if you're quiescent, you're still coded as PDR. It's almost like, and if you're severe in PDR, certainly your retinopathy severity could go down if you had some significant change in your health or your life. But most of the time, we keep the coding the same because there's some idea that not all the changes we're instituting may be permanent. For example, if you're injecting someone and they go from, you know, in the studies, they say, okay, you got a two-step reduction. You went from severe MPDR to moderate MPDR, right? I think most of us don't recode because we're just like, okay, there's no evidence that that's a permanent effect. Most of us believe it's probably not. Once you stop therapy, there is a risk that you'll go back and spring back to where you were. I think that's an interesting point to go on Kat's point. It's hard to capture it either way because you have jumps because patients present with a PDR-defining complication, or you aren't necessarily going to capture the reductions, which makes the data even more messy because I'm certainly some of these patients are going to have reductions and then you're not going to capture them depending on how people coded in the individual database you're looking at.
Great points all around. I think it's super interesting what you mentioned about the coding. I don't think any of us downcode. And I think it's, you know, it's obviously there's an anti-VEGF effect. I have patients who are PDR patients and I'm treating another, the other eye with anti-VEGF. If I want to get a good fluorescein angiography, I actually try to do a little bit of a washout period to get like a proper assessment. How much more PRP do I need to do? It's interesting about coding, right? Because a lot of these studies, and I think we've reviewed some of these on your podcast, Jay, it's, you know, they're retrospective studies and they're basically simply based on coding. I want to know who's doing that coding. Are all those retina specialists? Because there's a major difference in the grade of retinopathy between a general ophthalmologist, love them, but there's a big difference in how we code and like sort of the how accurately we code. The other thing is we all see patients who are, you know, out in the community being injected for the presence of fluid by our general ophthalmology colleagues. You know, and that's not wrong. We know that from protocol V, but I don't inject patients who are 20, 25, 20, 30 who are asymptomatic. So I think, you know, the challenge is who's making the diagnosis. And I think the idea of, and I think one of the studies that, you know, that is referenced here, there's a head-to-head comparison between insulin versus SGLT2 and GLP-1 agonists. But there's no placebo there. So all of these study designs have issues. And the thing is, that's why we need these large database studies, because in order to find these small drug-specific differences, you need a massive N. And I'm wondering, you know, if it's something like the Iris Registry, where we have more eye data, and perhaps we can, you know, more granularly look at who's making the diagnosis, maybe that'll provide some more insights as well.
Yeah, and your point about who's making the diagnosis, and again, we don't have great data on that. I would say the humble approach would be, I don't think we're even perfect ourselves at doing it, because the criteria that we technically should be using to make those grades, I mean, realistically, how many of us, you guys don't have to answer it, go put yourself on the spot, but how many of us are sitting there and counting quadrants of microaneurysms, hemorrhages? And really what you should be doing is going back to those original DRCR photos and comparing and be like, oh, which photo is this most? Like, none of us do that, right? And I'm sure we're fairly accurate, look at human studies, but that goes, Rams, in the question of like, grading in general probably needs to be updated, and we just haven't finished that part. But like, I would imagine there should be a whole new set of grading criteria based on wide field FA, right? And optos, that you could create a whole new set of criteria. And again, the criteria would be guided by what sort of findings are more likely to lead to complication and progression to the next stage, which was the whole point of staging. And sometimes I forget that. I think our students forget that. I think our fellows and residents forget that. But the whole goal of staging wasn't just to say, oh, this is stage 1 or 2 or 3 or 4. The whole goal of staging is to say, oh, if you're at this stage, your risk of complications and or progression to the next stage is X at X amount of time. And I think we're getting to the point where, to Sarwar's point on big data, we probably have enough wide field FAs between all these practices, it's just hard because they don't get pulled out in a database search. You'll get the interpretations, but you won't get the images. So I wonder, again, if you could pull all those images and then start getting some natural history of what happened to those patients and use AI leverage it and say, okay, these are these photos. This is what happened to the patient. Then it could start making predictions and saying, okay, based on this optos, this is what I grade the stage, and this is why I think it's this stage, because based on the history of these types of patients, this is what happens. That might be the most helpful to determine the small medication differences that Sarwar was talking about, because then you may actually find subtle things that we can't pick up by the human eye.
Yeah, no, I think that I would definitely agree with that. I think that would be way more objective, because at this point, there really isn't like a standardization, especially if you look at all the trials that they've been looking at. They had varying, you know, varying differences, like their outcomes were different in terms of what they looked at for DR progression. So it'd be nice to have a very standardized method of looking at it. And I think AI would be really helpful in that respect, just to kind of make it more standardized across the board.
And hold that thought, because I want to jump to DRCR. Christina Wang, again, friend of the program, wrote this with colleagues Noam Rundick, Kevin Blinder, Scott Friedman. It's the history and current directions of DRCR retina network. And this is, again, sort of a history. I will say I've never been good at memorizing all the DRCR studies. If you're a fellow, I remember there was a collaboration our year to try to write all these studies in a giant Google spreadsheet. And after like 2 days, people stopped updating it because it was just mind numbing to kind of look at it and try to remember. But obviously, it's weird. And so our references, I feel like we remember the studies that happened during our lifetime more than the studies we're trying to remember from like years ago. So like, we're like, oh yeah, protocol V, protocol W, protocol AB. But if someone's like, what was protocol D versus E versus F? It's much harder. There's a few things you could take from this. And they talk about some of the pivotal ones. If you want to look at the history, you can go back and look. I think that there's two interesting take homes from this. The first is, which if you're not aware, DRCR used to just be diabetic research, and they expanded in 2018, changed it to DRCR Retina Network. And that was the first thing they did, was pneumatic vitreolysis for VMT with or without macular holes. It was AG and AS, AH, H for hole. And then since then, now you can't just be like, oh, all the diabetic studies are there, because there's some non-diabetic studies that you have to remember. I think they do summaries of the big ones. They have a great table summarizing. So the big ones, again, we ran out of letters, and I think there may have been a better way to do this than to just add more letters on top. But I don't know if they can go back at this point. So AF, AL, AM, AO, AP. And then, you know, AF, fenofibrate versus placebo for DR worsening. That's something we've talked about way back with Craig Grevin when he talked about fibrates for DR. AL, radiation retinopathy. We've talked about that in the context of using fluocinolone implant or Luvian faricimab for radiation retinopathy. Immediate versus deferred surgery is AM for ERM, M for ERM. AO, home OCT, O for OCT for treat and extend for neovascular AMD. And then AP for panretinal photocoagulation. Do you do faricimab and panretinal photocoagulation, or do you do vitrectomy and intraoperative PRP, which is interesting. I'm not going to put you on the spot, Kat. If you had to pick one of these studies you're most interested, I'm not going to say least because I don't want to hurt anyone's feelings, but which of these results are you the most interested in from your own clinical perspective?
I think AO is going to be really interesting to see how that plays
home
out.
OCT.
I think that, yeah, home okay. OCT for sure. I feel like there's a lot of technology that we can use in our retina clinics. Like home OCT is approved, you know, photobiomodulation we've talked about before is approved. And some of the studies that were performed in order to get approval is very different than what we're used to. But I think that the way AO is constructed will be really nice to potentially see how that works of integrating that into sort of our practice. And I think that there's a lot of excitement as to potentially using that to decrease, you know, injection burden, both for patients and ourselves. Mm-hmm. So that's the one that I'm most excited about. And I agree with you, the naming of these is really hard. I was like editing the BCSC retina chapter on diabetes, and there's literally like, I think, a 3-page table out of all the DRCR studies. It's extensive.
Well, it makes you think there must have been humility there, right? Because they probably thought that they were never going to get far enough to run out of letters. Like, it would be like, we're like, hey, we're going to do 10 episodes of this podcast. Here's, you know, A through J. And the next thing you know, you're like 400 in. You're like, oh, wait, we need to actually put numbers on these. So I'm going to Zach, because I actually agree with Kat. I think that these are all interesting. I think that's the one that has the most potential to impact the field. The reason I'm going to zag is I'm going to argue, I don't think the reason home OCT has not been adopted, there's a lot of negatives there. I think the reason home OCT has not been adopted is practicality and not lack of belief in the science. So my argument would be, I think most retina doctors kind of know deep inside that home OCT would be helpful, but it just doesn't make sense in their practice workflow. It doesn't make sense integrating with EMR. They don't necessarily want to be doing these reads. And that's why I think 4C Home and these and Nodal Vision, all of this has taken time to get traction. Now, obviously, a trial result can push things along. We saw that with Protocol T, whereas aflibercept really got a bump in market share afterward. But I think that's an easier switch for people to be like, oh, I'm going to inject this drug instead of that drug, instead of changing their whole way that they manage their clinics. There's inertia in terms of pops. I'm not saying any of that is okay. I think there is a responsibility on us as clinicians to obviously strive to match the evidence. My whole thing is, I think there's been enough evidence that it's helpful. I don't think that, and maybe I'm wrong. Maybe you have a different perspective. So we're talking to colleagues. I don't think people are skeptical about home OCT in terms of like, oh, it could be helpful. I think most people are skeptical about, well, I don't think it works in the context of my individual practice.
You're totally right. I think the evidence is there. I mean, think about the number of times we see a patient, we're following them in one eye for wet AMD, and you know, we happen to catch new subretinal fluid in the other eye. And you know, like so many times I'm like, well, I'm glad you came in today and I'm glad we did the scan of both of your eyes, even though we don't necessarily need to because we're treating one eye. So I think there's definitely a benefit there. But I mean, you hit on the points, the challenges. Incorporation, right? I mean, as a small practice, how do I incorporate, you know, this additional, you know, these reams of data coming in? It's like, when am I going to, like, you have to carve out time in the week where you're interpreting these home OCT results. And then, you know, how much do we trust the technology? I think the technology is adequate. Mm-hmm. Is that time being reimbursed? I mean, we face so many pressures in all of our practice models. We need to see more patients, and you know, we have to do greater documentation, and there's greater, you know, challenges with prior authorization, step therapy. We're constantly being pushed from all these angles. And to add another thing, it's like, all right, well, if this study shows that, all right, this is the protocol, you know, based on like this many, you know, based on this finding, you should see them within a week. And or like the sensitivity of a positive finding is 98%. So you know what? Instead of me sitting there and reading that study, let's just schedule them for follow-up. You know what I'm saying? And if we can come up with a way that the workflow is streamlined, and honestly, the reimbursement landscape is not disincentivizing this additional work and workflow, I think, you know, it's a no-brainer, but these other issues have to be addressed.
Rams, what do you think? And feel free to put in a plug for radiation retinopathy, because I know you don't have to.
Yes, yes. So I actually, because I see a lot of diabetics in my practice. So I actually, you know, with protocol AP as well, I think I know that they would do well with vitrectomy and maybe intraoperative PRP, at least for many of my patients who come in with like recurrent vitreous hemorrhage, despite having very good, you know, PRP laser, and they're coming monthly for like injections and they rebleed even if you take them for vitrectomy at fault. You know, they're like very advanced diabetics. So I think I'm interested to see what that shows. However, like implementing that into my practice would be difficult because the sheer volume of patients who would require vitrectomy and intraoperative PRP would just be very high. Yeah. So I don't think it's actually practical, but it would just be interesting to see the data.
Yeah, that's a great county perspective. I agree. I mean, like the problem with it, again, not to poke holes, the problem with it is like, I feel it's such a nuanced decision because most of them, I agree, would probably do great by just taking them, stop the disease process, laser. I think the reason it's nuanced is every once in a while you have a patient who's probably a really poor candidate. And I just don't know. I have to look back at the criteria. I'm sure that there's some criteria in place where like they're not getting like bad TRDs, right? They're excluding a lot of fibroblasts with proliferation. I'm just thinking about perfusion status, right? Are they like some of these patients have bad macular ischemia, they're kind of teetering. And those are the patients you do a perfect surgery. And then afterward, you're like, well, the vision's worse than when you started. And it's because they lost some perfusion. But that's a fantastic point. And I love your point about like, what's the implementation going to be on a broader scale? I think that's a point that's brought up with vitrectomy, you know, CAT, Susvimo with the port delivery system, subretinal gene therapy, anything that requires taking a patient to the OR. Now you got to worry that they're Ozempic, they have to be off of it for a week, they're Jardiance, they have to be off it for 3 days, which again, those are real concerns. But it's not as simple. Like, I think that's the interesting part of how do you take, like, Kat, do you think that trial result's actually going to, that's the whole thing. I think there's two separate parts to a trial. It's like the science of it. And then the second, which I think is the part to jump to, is, does it change what people do? And I agree with Rams. I already sort of do that. So it's not going to change what I do, but is it going to change the minds of people who don't do that? And that's always the question for any of these trials.
Yeah, I had similar questions about AM, which is the immediate versus deferred, like membrane peel too. We were thinking about participating on that as a site. And so I sort of did the thought experiment. And it's just like the non-clearing VHs and those types of patients, you already spend like a fair amount of chair time and or decision based on individual characteristics or social situation about sort of what to do. So for people who I have strong feelings for that I should do one thing or the other, I'm never going to enroll that person in a trial. So I would have some inherent concerns that the patients who are in the trial might not be sort of most of the patients that sort of I see. So I don't know what about the generalizability of those studies.
And the fascinating part about what you just said, this is the same thing that's happened with randomized controlled trials for like RD repair. The part that won't be captured unless they report it is how often do the clinicians see a patient who would have been a candidate, but then they didn't ever actually put them in the trial because they made their own decision because they felt really strongly about it. And so they were sort of enrolled, but not enrolled. And so, like, I'd be really curious for a trial like that, how many were screened? And then the physician was like, well, I know they got randomized to this, but I don't want to do that. So I'm going to do what I think is best, which you have to write into the protocol. And then, like, well, then how useful are the results? That was always the argument, like the buccal versus vitrectomy randomized control trial is like, in the end, they're like, well, we defer to the physician. And if you look, like, I don't remember the number, but it was high. It was like over a quarter of those cases, I think. The physicians have sort of changed their mind based on what they thought. And then you're like, well, if they're doing that, then there's selection bias baked in that the only ones that they're leaving for, let's say, buckling in that example, are the ones they thought this is a slam dunk. I don't need to do a vit. Let's jump completely to something different, though, since we're talking about home OCT. This is called remote OCT protocol to speed diagnosis and treatment of CREO. Keva Lee and Gareth Lemma did this write-up. This is interesting, right? So they're talking about CREO, they call it a stroke of the eye, and they're trying to talk about remote diagnosis of this to speed up intervention for CREO. So they defined essentially an eye stroke protocol. Patients present to ED, stroke code is activated, and then they get an OCT from the stroke team. Ophthalmology is not on site. And then they're looking for interretinal hyperreflectivity, thickening of the inner retina, loss of distinction between layers, fundus photo with a foveal glow, all things that we'd all agree are characteristic of a CREO. And then immediately the image goes to the ophthalmology team. If they confirm, patient is treated with intravenous tPA if they're within 4.5 hours of last known well time where they had vision, or they go for angiography with tPA into the ophthalmic artery. And so this is very, very interesting, right? Because first of all, they talk about this. Like, you need every service has got to be on board. If anyone misses a page, if someone isn't looking at their phone, it's not going to work. The images have to be high quality enough. You need to have the OCTs. Like, they say put the OCT next to the CT scanner, which is fascinating. I wonder what other services think about that. You have this little like thing in the corner. They're like, what is that? It has to be user-friendly for OCT capture. And then they get rid of ultrasounds, which are often done by ER doctors. In fact, ER doctors are like more and more well trained than I ever thought to try to do B scans, but they don't really think about OCT. And then you need to have a communication system. This goes back to what Sarwar was talking about, home OCT. How do you communicate this? Who is responsible for immediately answering this page? How is that reimbursed? Is it even reimbursed if they're on call? And then they talk about 18 months. They had 59 patients evaluated, 42% had confirmed CREOs. 9 of the 10 treatments, and it was within an average of 9 hours within last known well. Again, they said 4.5 hours, and they said vision got better. Average vision went from hand motion to 2100. 66% of patients improved from worse than 2200 to 2100 or better. Although, and then 44% of patients were 20/40 or better within 24 hours of treatment. So, Sarwar, this is in your city. If they can do it in New York, they can do it anywhere. Maybe, maybe not. What do you think? Do you like this?
I think this is great. I mean, this has actually been rolled out in a lot of like the ERs in New York. And I take call at a hospital in Long Island. And you know, one of the you know, there's a Maestro OCT there. So, you know, it's actually the it you have to put in a lot of work in the beginning to train the staff to get at least a good quality image. But I mean, I'm routinely getting, you know, it's a quick, you know, basic fundus photo or a you know, and an OCT, and you know, I can put in a quick, you know, basically assessment like, okay, this is a patient, you know, it's consistent with the history, So I think it can work really well. I mean, Gareth Lima is a good friend. He's like one of the smartest people I know. He's a great advocate for our profession. And he's very thoughtful. I mean, I think they put a lot of thought into this, and they, I think this is, I mean, these are compelling results. I mean, some of the challenges are, you know, how much do we, but my question is, how much can we push the boundary on this? And some of these 4.5 hour time points are from the stroke literature, right?
Right.
But, you know, is it, can we push this? If someone comes in at 6 hours, you know, if I have a family member with this, I want them to get the TPA, because the thing is, we know that reperfusion, you know, can, you know, result in improvement. Have we shown, as far as I know, I don't think we've shown that there's a time point beyond which this intervention is no longer beneficial. So that's what comes to mind, because I think these are compelling results, and I hope this is, and I think this is being rolled out nationally in ERs, especially in more rural areas, and I think it'll really help a lot of patients. But I want to know how far we can push it, because a lot of times, you know, if someone says, "I woke up with vision loss, last known well could be
Yeah.
8 hours ago," but does that mean we just write that patient off, or do we try to at least help that patient, or do we come up with a protocol like, you know what, maybe intra-arterial is not a good option for you, but you know what, you can get intravenous. And I think we'll have to rely on our neurology colleagues, because there are some compelling data points from what I remember from med school, from the neurology literature.
I think it's great. And Rams, you comment maybe on timing, because here they extended, it was double. I mean, what they said was suggested, and still the outcomes were good. I'm sure they didn't get every patient. It's just interesting that you still got those results, which is again a why the time points are they arbitrary when it comes to CRA. We don't really know 100%. I mean, you would think, I was always taught that you had like half an hour, 60 minutes. Like I was always taught these things in the context of intravitreal injections. You inject someone, if they're blacked out, you should do something within like 5 to 10 minutes, but this shows that you have more time than that potentially. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, no, I think Sarwar brings up a lot of good points. I think like it is really important to know how far we can push it, because as Sarwar mentioned, if it was my family member, I would want them to get the TPA, just because the visual outcomes can be so poor with CRAO. And then after that, there's really not much you can do. In terms of like here, implementing that, the challenges would be like, you know, by the time, you know, residents here cover 4 sites, so by the time the resident is able to come assess the patient, and then the stroke code is, you know, is done, it's already been a long time. So it would be great to have some sort of protocol in place here where we could do what they're doing on the East Coast, because I think we could save a lot of people's vision. I actually personally haven't seen a patient with CRAO come in on time to actually receive treatment as of yet.
Yeah.
So.
And that may be a county thing. It may also be in New York, you're so close physically to so many hospitals. I wonder, Kat, geographically, there's that time added. Cleveland's not exactly remote, but I'm sure you get patients from large amounts of time. And then you think about that loss of time, right? Patient is 4 hours away. They go see somebody in practice and they're like, oh, you have CRAO, go straight there. But by the time they're waiting in the waiting room, they get seen, they get an appointment. Like it almost means you'd have to educate. The problem with this is not just educating referring doctors, which is what we often do. Here, you need patient education. And patient education for a problem that isn't that well known would kind of fall into that stroke umbrella where you have to really educate patients that it's like, oh, okay, this could be a symptom of a stroke. You need to call a 911. Not pick up the phone and call your optometrist to get an appointment the next day.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is amazing that they were able to put this protocol together, and it sounds like it's really nicely been implemented at some places. Call me a skeptic. I just have trouble seeing how
Love
this would
it.
sort of roll out to different medical systems. Like we had our resident research day like a week ago, and I remember hearing some of our residents sort of joking that, you know, if someone in the emergency room, it's not necessarily a physician, but like there's people at different levels call ophthalmology consults, and if someone has vision loss in one eye, that like differential is like angle closure glaucoma, retinal detachment, like CRAO. Like, how are you going to decide like what's a CRAO and what's not? You know, it's oftentimes it feels like some of the people who are triaging these people, and I'm not knocking anyone, I don't know much about the body outside of the eye, but like, how are they going to be able to really tell what's going on? And then if we start activating a protocol like this for everyone who has, you know, painless vision loss in one eye, like, what's vision loss? Is it more than 20/25? You know, is it, does it have to be like count fingers? How does that play out? Like, you know, who's going to be able to like read an OCT, have an OCT that's like properly maintained? Like, what's the impetus on us or someone in our position to be available? Well, and then, you know, in our conversation, we're talking about like TPA or TNK, whatever people use now, as being this benign thing that we would always want. But to be honest, I mean, like you can have very serious complications from using those medicines as well. So, you know, I think it's just I think it's a really complex issue. And I just see a lot of significant concerns about how this would actually play out in practical and like real healthcare systems.
Well, it's a good idea pointing out the downside. I also think about medical legally, and maybe this isn't the reason not to do it, but if this pendulum swings far enough where it's like, hey, like you're expected as a stroke center to be able to do this, and then something doesn't happen, you put now, weirdly enough, by trying to help people, you've opened yourself up with liability, which is a horrible thing to think about when you're trying to help people. But like, if you now have an expert witness, not that Gareth would do this, but goes up there and is like, oh, you know, the class in a, if a well-run protocol, you should have the OCT. And if they fail to get the OCT in time and the ophthalmologist failed to respond in a timely manner, that is sort of the Pandora's box you're opening, because now you're creating an expectation that this is solvable. And that is not a reason to not solve it, but it's something you have to think about, is how do you manage that medical legally? Is there a requirement now to be a stroke? Is it stroke center plus? Like, is it, we are a stroke center, but we don't offer this? Or is it stroke centers are now expected that they should be able to do this? That's an interesting point. Kat, go ahead.
No, I think that's a totally valid point. I think a lot of us here trained in places where we had eye emergency rooms. And this didn't happen to me, but it happened to one of my like co-residents at the time, but there was a CSIRS report filed on us for someone who's working in the mass eye and ear emergency room, that TPA was not given to a patient with the CREO at our institution, like in our emergency room within a certain amount of time by like our adjoining hospital. We're like, we have one nurse for the entire emergency room.
Right.
Like, we are not set up to do TPA or like any sort of clot busting medicine. So you just have to think about sort of, unfortunately, but like, how would this apply to everyone? And, you know, it's hard, but you have to think about the practical concerns as well as sort of the like responsibilities we would have.
We're going to run through this last one fast. And you guys have been really generous with your time. Mrinali Gupta is a friend, very brilliant and humble person, wrote this great article about building your practice. I think this is relevant for any stage of your career, but if you're a fellow, especially you're nearing graduation, this is a great quick thing to read. Basically, I think the three big points are, you know, building your referrals, whether you're in private practice or academics, how do you communicate with those people? Second would be, how do you handle actual issues with the OR? How do you handle complications? And the last is the practical concerns. How do you get prepared to operate alone? How do you go to the OR, know how it works, know how the EMR works, know which patients to sign up when you start? Rams, I think this is great advice all along. I mean, I think that the one thing I'll say, and again, not to make this spicy, I think one of the hard parts is, I feel, again, there's generational criticism. I think sometimes people criticize younger generations, saying they don't do these things. They don't do the soft skills. They don't do the phone calls. They don't send the messages. They say they don't do the same preparation. They don't do the same growth. And then they sort of look down in disdain or sort of bewilderment. They're like, why aren't they doing these things? And I think if you think from the younger generation standpoint, people are just inundated in residency and fellowship with more stuff, to put it in a very grammatically correct way. There's more stuff to do. There's more messages to handle. There's more sort of EMR BS that you got to do. There's more things in your email inbox every day. And that doesn't excuse you for not trying to be personally excellent. It just makes it really hard to see the reason that you did it. And so I would just say the big take home for me would be, this is about personal excellence. It's not about making your referring doctors happy. It's not about making your attending happy. It's not about making your patients even happy. Just about like deciding for yourself, how good do you want to be at these things? And there is a payoff if you invest the time to improving. Any thoughts or comments on that? Because I feel like this, again, could easily be weaponized to someone saying like, oh, these are the things that our fellows don't do, or our new graduates don't do, or a new Dr. X doesn't do. But I think then it results weirdly, like it does with children, where then they just are like, well, I'm not going to do that thing that you're telling me I don't do, because I don't have bandwidth to do it. I think it just is just good stuff to implement. Just don't put so much pressure on yourself to do all of it at once, because I have fallen off the wagon with every single one of these things at various points, and that is okay.
Yes. No, I think the way Mrinali kind of breaks it down is really great. You know, coming out of fellowship, I think you think like everything is going to be a lot easier and you're finally out as an attending. And then you have this kind of rude awakening that, no, this is actually going to be really hard, especially those first few years when you're starting to build your practice. You really are kind of at, you need to work with your referring doctors really closely. You need to, I know many times I had to take on emergencies, after hours, just as a favor for these referring doctors. So I would continue to get referrals and like build trust with them. So I feel like the first few years, it can be really difficult, very stressful, easy to get burnt out, but it does reap its rewards later, I think, putting in the time. But it's also important to also kind of balance wellness and like to try to not burn out so early. So just take on what as much as you can without burning out and try to continue to do all the stuff you want to do with your family or whatever brings you happiness.
So our comments, thoughts on this?
Oh, I love this article. I mean, especially I think it's applicable to all of us. I think I loved, what you two said so far about, showing your making time for yourself and just showing yourself some grace. I mean, those first 6 months, every single complication. I remember that my first rate attachment, my failed vitrectomy, is because the patient didn't position. But that conversation, I was like literally like my legs were shaking because I had never done that before. And like, I was like, is it me? And I think like there's like forums like this podcast, and there's like the people are becoming more humble and talking about the challenges, I remember I had like even last week I had a really rough case where, like an RD ended up with like massive choroidals and I couldn't operate and had to do it was a disaster basically. An hour case, an expected hour case ended up being 2.5 hours. And afterwards, I just sent a massive voice note to like a few of my co-fellows and like, guys, this is what happened. And like, sort of like the immediate recognition, like, dude, that sounds like a rough case. You handled it well. And this community where we have, and we should like Murnali mentions this, like have your community, have your sort of tribe where you can reach out and vent about these cases and show yourself grace. And to this day, before every OR day, I, also do this, like, I mean, I'm like over 5 years out now. I go through, no matter how straightforward or how complex, I go through little bullet points like, all right, this fake it, don't forget to not cross. Like, these are things that I already know, but that meditative process I find super helpful. And, it sort of helps me feel like I've done everything to prepare for that case. Because at the end of the day, all we can control, and it's one thing that you realize probably a year into training, is that all you can control is yourself, and you all you have to do is your best, and then you leave the rest up to the magical healing processes of nature.
Yeah, I love it. And Kat, he brought up some excellent points. And I think one of the things he talked about was the debris of complications. Like, it briefly touched on this article, but it's hard when you get complications. And it is very, very cathartic to talk about it with other people versus if you don't, it no matter how much you think you can compartmentalize, it eats into your life, it eats into your home life, it eats into your clinic the next day. It's just to sort of how to process that and move forward without being, again, it's so hard to be in between, without being cavalier and just throwing up your hands and saying, well, this patient was bad pathology and blah, blah, blah. I think we've all seen, unfortunately, surgeons who kind of don't take the ownership and then not just burning out the other way, where you just, just completely turtle over time because you just can't take it inside it because you keep taking all the bad news inside and not talking about it. It's just going to eat you up from the inside out.
Yeah, no, I think those are really good points. We're so used to going to conferences, when we're fellows and when we're sort of attendings where people show amazing cases that they did, where they had like really complex cases. The surgery went great, and then the patient has a fantastic outcome. The hard thing is that's not, usually the day-to-day experience of being a retina surgeon. Like we may achieve our surgical goals, but it might not be, without sort of some hiccups along the way. And, as time goes on, like, I think being a surgeon, we used to think about sort of the technical aspects of, at least I used to think about the technical aspects of being a surgeon is what made you a good surgeon. But I think actually all the things that Bernali mentions here is what makes you a good surgeon, is being sort of mindful, preparing well, like thinking through potential like complications, like, watching the patient postoperatively and how you handle those complications. That's what actually makes you like a really good surgeon. And, I say this all the time, but like retina surgery is super humbling. Like my OR day is Friday, and I had this re-op on Friday that I was just like really worried about. And I just sort of said to our fellow, I was like, I couldn't sleep last night. I was like worried about this case. He was just like, but you're like 6 years in. And I was like, it doesn't go away. Like you still worry about people. And,
Being attending is hard. Being a fellow is harder, and it's less financially rewarding. So I don't want fellows listening to this being like, oh my God, attendings complaining about their lives again. But thank you all for your time. If there are fellows listening, again, this is pre-graduation. As you go out in the world, if you don't have a community, if feel free to reach out to me, any of the people on this podcast. We're all here. It's a small community. We all like to support each other. So Rams Narala, Kat Talcott, Star Wars Ahid, thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks, Jay.
Thanks, Jay.
Many thanks to Drs. Narala, Talcott, and Zahid for joining me for this episode. Listeners, remember you can find all 468 of our episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. Remember, all episodes are there sorted by category. You can also reach us, give us feedback on episodes. You can email me directly at retinapodcast@gmail.com or by clicking on the contact us link on our website. In terms of our thanks always go out to our production team. That includes Drs. Justin Ma and Louis Kai. Thanks to the listeners who make this possible by listening, giving us feedback, seeing patients, publishing articles, inspiring the discussions we have here each episode. This is Jay Schreeder signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.